Good evening.
Yeah, it's nice to be here. She didn't tell you all that much, did she? So I'm a philosopher, but I used to be an electronic engineer, and I worked as one for 15 years. So I'm in the uncomfortable position that when I'm with philosophers, I'm an engineer, and when I'm with engineers, I'm a philosopher. So I would, you know, you never know if you're scratching where it's itching or whether you're speaking to the on the right, you know, in the right way. Or, so please let's interact as much as possible. You know, if I'm going too slowly or too fast, so, help me. And so that we, you know, it's a very square, formal little room, but. you all have a glass of wine in the hand, and so do I, and it will be okay. So, I did, as an engineer, work on pattern recognition and, being interested in philosophy already, a little bit of artificial intelligence and these issues, and started working on intelligent systems that actually work, like the brain. And sort of this led to an interest in complexity, which is a theme that I've been working in for, 25 years now. So I have a colleague who is a biochemist, Jannie Hofmeyer, and together the two of us, we have a Center for Studies in Complexity at the University of Stellenbosch. So there is a resource there also to take note of. So what I propose to do is to sort of talk about complexity in general a little bit, and then hopefully it engages you in a way so that you can reflect on your own problems and own issues, and that we sort of slowly turn it into more of a discussion. In a traditional sort of scientific presentation, where I am going to talk about complexity, I should start off by giving you a definition of what complexity is. But I'm not going to. And I suspect you can see why not. It has to do with a notion, definition. You know, because what does a definition do? Reduces, it converges, it focuses, and so you can see there's a certain tension already in them just talking about complexity, you know, defining it, saying what it is. But it's not a tension that leaves us in mid-air. There are lots of things, substantial things we can say about complexity, but always it's always a little bit uncomfortable. So instead of defining it, and there are, in certain contexts, there are definitions of complexity. There are mathematical definitions, there are computational definitions, algorithmic definitions in terms of the length of programs, Chaitin's work. So there are many attempts, but I want to engage with the notion in a slightly more general way. So in order to do that, what I prefer is a number of distinctions and some characteristics, so that instead of defining it in some sort of crisp analytical way, you build up a network of notions that from which some sort of understanding of what the notion means can emerge. So a good point to start is to make a distinction between complex and complicated. So something can be very complicated, but in principle, we can understand it. We can take it apart and put it back together again and know how it works. So something like a jumbo jet. Maybe no single person understands the whole jumbo jet, but in principle, it is understandable. When something is complex, we say it has a complex system, has properties that you cannot predict by looking at the components of the system. So there are properties that arise because of the relationship between the components in the system that are not reducible to the components themselves. Now, the example I usually use of a jumbo jet is complicated, but mayonnaise is complex. If you look at egg and oil, you don't see mayonnaise. Have you ever made mayonnaise? I mean, it is a rather exciting activity. We just buy the stuff in a bottle. But to make it from scratch, in the first place, it's not easy. And, you know, what you see before your eyes, you have these things you know, and it turns into something completely different. So this is what we call emergent properties. So a complex system has emergent properties which are not reducible to the components. What would examples of emergent properties? Consciousness as an emergent property of a bunch of neurons. Meaning as an emergent property of a set of words related in a certain way. If you think of the economic system, which is just pushing money around, it's something like inflation, you know, or GDP, or interest rate. All these things are emergent properties of a system of interaction. So, emergent properties are problematic things and difficult things, and not so easy to deal with. So, in that sense, maybe mayonnaise is not the best example. Because if you understand the science of emulsification, and you know, then you can sort of work it out, and you know what it is. And maybe many of these emergent properties we know, it's just we could argue it's just because of a lack of knowledge. If we understand it better, then it will. Well, then the system will just be very complicated, not complex. Is complexity just a function of our understanding of the system, or is the characteristic of the system itself? Are there things that are irreducibly complex? And so that's an open question. What is interesting, too, is that things that may seem quite simple, once you start dealing with them in detail, suddenly they become more complex than you thought they were. So you say a rabbit is more complex than a rock, intrinsically independent of my description of it, but rocks can be quite complex things when you have to deal with them in certain ways. So this notion of emergence is not an easy. It may be our understanding. Some people don't like the notion of emergence because they say it's sort of mystical. It's a word for just I don't know. But at this stage, given our knowledge, given that we are human beings with finite time and finite capacities, I think there are certainly things that are, for us, irreducibly complex and really emergent. You know, if you talk to biologists, they will tell you that despite all the progress and all the definitions, we really don't know what life is. So life is one of those prime examples of an emergent property. You have a number of constituents that we understand better and better, and some of it quite well, but still there's something elusive about this idea of what is life. And that, it's a very good example of the difficulty of dealing with complex things. The traditional way of dealing with a complex system, as engineers, we all know what we do. We subdivide it into subsystems that are less complex. It's called analysis, the analytic method. It's the standard method in science. Divide, and then once you've done that, you synthesize. You put it back together again, and now you know what is going on. But you can see this is a little bit problematic if you're dealing with emergent properties. Because what happens if you analyze, subdivide the system? The emergent property disappears. Now, so I want to study life. So I take a living thing and I cut it up in the system. Well, life is gone. Does it come back when I put them back together again? No, normally not. So there's a dilemma here, though. if you want to deal with something in its complexity, there's just too much. You know, you just say, this thing is alive, and there's millions of cells and things interacting. I have to simplify it in order to be able to say something about it. But as soon as I do that, I disturb the system in some fundamental way so that it's not the same system anymore. And I think it is exactly in this dilemma that an acknowledgement of complexity sits, and that is something that we have to do because we all deal with complex systems in some way or another all the time. Okay, so I've been using the word system as if we all know what it is. It is in itself a problematic notion, but you see, I'm not going to explain anything to you. I'm just going to give you more problems. But I think... But I think the notion of system, the acknowledgement of the notion of system is vitally important. It already implies a shift away from some kind of atomistic thinking to some kind of relational thinking, where there's a process with relationships. I'll get back to that. So the notion of system is important. I also think the notion of network is important. I find the notion of network a very useful metaphor to think about complex systems. Systems theory, traditional classical systems theory, likes to work with feedback systems. So if we think in that way, we tend to think of just sort of black boxes with inputs and outputs and feedbacks. And control engineers like to solve those problems, and they're good at it. But I don't think that's really a strong enough metaphor for how systems work. To think in terms of a network, a network not like a fishing net with sort of square matrix, but lots of nodes interacting, multidimensional, where it is difficult to talk about sort of the limits, the ends of the network, and I'll get to that again in a little bit. I just want to make sure that if we think of a sort of network theory, sort of lots of nodes interacting, then this is not the same as something that is random or chaotic. So a network which is interacting and connected, these networks have structure. It's not so easy to pin down a structure, but it is not random or chaotic. And we'll get back to that in a moment. So what I tend to work with is a number of characteristics of these complex systems. And as you know, if we want to talk about complexity, we should spend, a week, a month, a year. We have 10 minutes, so I'll run through them quickly. And then we'll see how if you want to pick up on any of these themes. So a complex system consists of components where the complexity is not in the components but in their relationship. So the components can be simple, but you still have a complex system. Depending on how you define your system, the components can be complex too. If you model a social network, and you say the components are human beings, of course they are complex. It's a system in itself. So it depends a little bit on your description. You have to be careful. But the central point is the complexity need not reside in the components themselves. The complexity is a result of the process of interaction. So these components are therefore connected, they interact. They interact dynamically, which means the interaction between them changes. The interaction is quite rich. And many of these things are much easier for me to explain in this context than when I have to talk to social scientists. The idea of a combinatorial explosion, where you have, even if something is sparsely connected, but it's connected to a few of them and very quickly, things are richly connected. So if you have a network, there are just some components which are richly connected. Everything is connected to everything else fairly quickly. The central argument, something on which a lot of my a lot of my conclusions or implications rest on is the fact that the interactions between the components in the system are non-linear. Now, you know what non-linearity is, so I don't have to work too hard tonight. So, two characteristics of non-linearity is the non-linear relationship between cause and effect. So, small causes can have large effects, but also the other way around. Or, small causes can have small effects. But the relationship between cause and effect is not linear. The second, and this is a very important one, is the fact that if you have a nonlinear system, now you have to think it's not just one or two nonlinear things following on each other. It's a network of nonlinear relationships. If these relationships are nonlinear, it means that the law of superposition doesn't hold, which means you cannot simplify the network. If they were linear relationships, you can compress it. If it's nonlinear, you cannot compress it without losing something. So that is the key one. So components interact, so influences flow through the network, but they are changed as it mediated as the interactions, the influences are mediated by other components in the system. Not only is there mediation, but there's lots of feedback because it's a network, and it's not feedback like the control systems little model likes to show. There's multiple feedback. There are short feedback loops and long feedback loops, and you know, feedback from all sorts of. So you get the idea now. It's a lot of simultaneous nonlinear interaction with feedback, and it's a quagmire. how do you deal with it? So let's just add a few other characteristics. Complex systems are open systems. They interact with their environment in such a way that you cannot really say much about the system without also saying something about the environment at the same time. They have to interact. I think closed systems can at most be complicated. There are actually very few examples of really closed systems. Maybe a chemical reaction in a thermos flask or something like that. But systems interact with their environment. In order to have a complex structure, the energy has to flow through the system. That's why we also say that the systems operate under conditions far from equilibrium, in the sense that they need energy in order to fight against the second law of thermodynamics. So this is the points made by Prigogine. The notion of equilibrium is of course a difficult one. Economists like to use the notion in a slightly different way. And one should not confuse equilibrium with stability. A system can be stable and not in equilibrium. If a system is really in equilibrium, it can only be, there's only one word to describe it really. It is dead. Okay, so complex systems are also systems because they are dynamic, there's a flow of energy, they interact with their environments. So they are temporal in nature. They exist in time. They cannot be frozen. They're not like Newtonian things that are reversible in time. So the history of a system is important. Previous states are part of what the system is now and part of how the system will look in future. I'm sorry if this is all too abstract. You should sort of think, I'm sure you're thinking of something that you know and seeing what I'm saying makes sense. Yes. Nah, that's simple.
Yeah.
Exactly. No, it's a very good example for more than one reason. if you go back to where we started, is we think of complex systems consists of many components. And then we tend to think that complexity is a function of quantity. There are many components, it must be. That's not the point. It's a function of the relationships. So you can have a system with few components that is very complex, like marriage. And let me just say, I know of no marriage that consists only of two components. There are often children and usually parents and in-laws, and so it's a little system, and highly non-linear, and it has emergent properties. But not completely unpredictable. You know, after a while, there are also certain patterns that you recognize. So that's when... not in a deterministic way, but you can make an educated guess. Yeah. And that, exactly, but this is an important point, because this is where we come in, that try to understand and model these systems. They are complex, but they have structures, and there are certain things that you can say something about, that you can do, that you recognize, that is repeatable, but at the same time, you should be careful about it, because you may also be wrong. Yeah. Okay.
Something like Conway's Game of Life, which is, you know, Conway's Game of Life, yeah. There's only three rules, and
this.
It's still new.
Okay, so whether that is complex or complicated is an interesting question. So, But on the first level, yes. So cellular automata and those kind of things, you can say have emergent properties. The problem is that they are fairly repeatable. You know, if you do it exactly the same, you get exactly the same pattern again. Whereas, because there are usually few components and few rules, but if you have a system with an environment and the changes and the, then what worked today is not necessarily going to work tomorrow, as you seem to know. Okay, so the last point here is just to say that if you have a network that has complex behavior, sort of an economic system or a marriage or a ecosystem, then the complexity is not situated somewhere in the network. The complexity is distributed over the network. So no single component in the system has access to all the complexity. This is an important point to realize, because it means that when we deal with complexity, especially when we're part of the system, then we only have access to a certain amount of it, to sort of local information in a certain sense. But local is not meant in a spatial sense, but just the things that I do have access to. So this idea of distribution, this is also part of the emergence argument. In philosophy, there's there's this idea, where's your little, the middle one? There you go. The idea of a homunculus is a sort of old philosophical trick. That if you try to understand, you know, how does a human being work, how does the brain work, well, there's a little man inside. You know? It was always a little man sitting inside that does all the work. So you shift the properties of the system to some sort of essential component that sits there. You know, Descartes talked about the relationship between body and mind, and but he had to find a place for it. It was in the pituitary gland. You know, there it sits. So this is the idea that there must be some essence somewhere. Complexity denies that. This is, there isn't some essential component inside. The characteristics of a system is exactly sort of a result of the spreading out of everything. All right. So that gives you some sort of understanding of some of the characteristics. And I said these have a number of consequences. So the nonlinearity, you cannot compress complexity. It's irreducible. Or you cannot compress it without losing something, without introducing some kind of error. These are still the sort of philosophical, grand, general, abstract arguments. We'll deal with them a little bit more. So the fact that you have this sort of network of interactions with emergent properties is not, does not deny causality. So the properties of the network are causal, but it's because of little micro-causes interacting all the time. It's much more difficult to identify some sort of grand cause and some grand outcome. You have things that are still deterministic or are still causal, but not in a deterministic way that you can stand back and trace these causes through the system. There's just too much going on. If a system is incompressible, you cannot describe the system precisely in terms of a number of features, of specific limited rules, a set of features. You'll see we do that, but the argument is that that cannot capture the complexity of the system. Despite all that, we say the complex system is not chaotic, it's not arbitrary, it has structure. So for those of you who know something about it, I make a rather strong distinction between chaos theory and complexity theory. So some of the traditions in complexity theory grew out of chaos theory, but chaos theory is still a deterministic form of thinking about things. There are constants, universal, the Feigenbaum's universals, and all sorts of things in there that is not, it's not quite what we mean when we talk about complexity. So that's a whole thing, theme in itself. Okay. So this is the sort of critical part, breaking it open, saying something about how difficult this problem is that we have to deal with when we deal with complex systems, which you have to deal with all the time. Now, given the theme, I thought in this context it may be interesting to say a little bit about boundaries. How do we think of a system? So we said complex systems are open systems, let me just think of a slightly less abstract story for a moment. If you want to model some aspects of the economic system in the Western Cape, do I have to model the weather in Brisbane? Well, you see, in a certain sense, it sounds like this is too far away. It's got nothing to do here. But if you start just unpacking the problem a little bit, if I model the economic system, do I have to model the agricultural system? Of course I have to. If I model the agricultural system, do I have to model other agricultural systems that this agricultural system interact with? Of course I have to. If I model agricultural systems, do I have to model the weather? Of course I have to. So what do I have to model if I want to model anything that's complex? Really? I have to model the universe. Huh? So if you really want to model anything, you have to model the universe.
The universe is already a very good model of itself. Huh? The universe is already a very good model of itself.
It's the only one we have, yeah. So that is the radical part of the problem. But still, if we talk, we can talk about systems that are more specific. I mean, I can talk about me or you as a system. And that means we can distinguish between what is part of that system and what is not part of that system. Otherwise, we can't use the word system at all. So the notion system presupposes some sort of idea of what belongs to it and what does not belong to it. So in that sense, systems do have boundaries, even if they are open. So how do we think of boundaries if we have this sort of this double nature? Yeah? On the one hand, it is operationally closed, so that we can talk of the system. At the other hand, it's open and it interacts with anything, everything else. So I propose is that we shift this thinking about boundaries in a slightly different direction, and say that the boundary of a system is not just confining in closing it off; it is enabling. The boundary is necessary for the system to be what it is. it is not only, it's, you know, it's bad news and good news at the same time. So think of the eardrum. The eardrum is the boundary between the brain and the outside world. But it exists in order to let sound through. But more than that, if it wasn't there, the sound wouldn't be able to go through. So the boundary which separates the brain from the outside world is actually the thing that enables you to engage with the outside world. So we should not think of boundaries as negative things or as sort of delineating between one thing and another, but actually as a form of interaction. What that says about the modeling problem, I think, is difficult, but I'll say something about that again. So again, this is an argument for structure, that boundaries and systems have structure, and that structure is enabling, that you need structure for interesting behavior to happen. I like the example of music. If you think of, if we would have a piece of music in which there is total freedom, we all perform a piece of music together, and everybody can do just what they want to, give free expression to it, what would happen? It's noise, huh? And if we repeat the exercise tomorrow, will it sound any different? It will still be noise. Although if we have a certain bit of structure, you know, there's a score or there's something, but you still have to express it in a certain way. That structure turns noise into music. So we need structure, you know, for certain things to happen. If you think of yourself, you're a complex system. But you wake up in the morning with your arms more or less in the same place. This is not a coincidence. This is important because it enables you to do things. You know, if you were not sure whether you were going to have hands tomorrow or not, then you wouldn't be able to continue to exist, to do interesting things. So this being in time, the idea of boundaries, the structure is enabling. So you're beginning to see the good news. There are patterns and structures that we can also get at, even though these patterns and structures are complex. Where is the boundary? That's another type of question we want to ask. Is there a boundary here and an inside and an outside? That's the simple way. That's the sort of control engineering way again. But if you think of a network, sort of a network of interactions, and if every component in that network is connected to every other component in that network, where is the boundary? So we tend to think of it. Now, there are some components on the boundary, and there are some components safely in the middle that's far away from the boundary. But if everything is connected to everything else, then everything is on the boundary. Then the boundary is not out there. The boundary is folded into the systems. We're never far away from the boundary when we are dealing with things that are richly interconnected. Let's skip hierarchies. Let's not talk. So, to wrap up a little bit, let's not go too philosophical. Let's talk a little bit about the relationship between knowledge, our understanding of complex systems, and the system. So if we say that part of dealing with a complex system is somehow to define its boundaries in such a way that I can make it manageable, then I'm including and excluding certain things. So if I want to talk about a complex system, I cannot talk about it in its complexity. I cannot talk about all the millions of things at the same time. I pick out certain features. So what do I do? When we talk about complexity, in order to be able to talk about them, we reduce the complexity. We have to. Otherwise, we can't say anything. But what do we know now? If we reduce the complexity, there are problems. Huh? So here is a quite profound little philosophical moment here. Huh? So in order to have knowledge, we have to reduce the complexity, and this introduces an error. Thus, our knowledge of complex systems are per definition flawed. No? Now, this sounds like terrible news, as if, you know, if we can't get it right. But if it is like that, well, and we acknowledge it, then it puts us in another mode. It's like the guy said, since I gave up hope, I felt much better. So now we can engage with these systems again, but we engage with them in a slightly different way. Now we know that the models we make are problematic. Or not problematic, but limited. They are not perfect. And if we know that, we will go about developing them in a different way, and we will go about using them in a different way. And it is at exactly at this point that some sort of ethics starts to creep into the argument. If we know that our models are somehow flawed, not necessarily badly flawed, that some of them can be quite good, if we know that there could be a problem, and what do we know about this problem? Not what it is, but we know some of its characteristics. These things that we are not considering, that we are leaving out, that are related to the system in a nonlinear way. Which means, even though they look small, under certain conditions, they may have large effects. If we know that, I say that we will model with a certain modesty. We will not claim neutrality or objectivity or cleverness, or maybe some wisdom. Yeah? In the sense that you model, this is no argument against hard work. So you do all the hard work you can, all the calculation you can, collecting all the data you can, but you know you're not going to get it perfect. So you offer your model with a certain modesty, and with that, the most important part of this modesty is that you're also willing to revise the model. So provisionality, the revisability of the model becomes part of the modeling process right from the start. Not when you find out it's not going to work, because you know it's not going to work under certain conditions. So this sort of inaugurates a shift in attitude in how we do science. This is not an excuse for bad science. This is not an argument for relativism. Anything goes. This is just as good as that. That's not the point. Systems have patterns. We recognize them. They survive. Most of them are quite robust. But we do not have the methods to reduce the characteristics of our system to a number of simple principles that we can stick into an algorithm, and there it goes. Okay. So let's just summarize this idea on modeling, because this may be something that many of you will be interested in. We model all the time. So not only mathematical models or computational models, but if I write a narrative description, it's a model. If I write a novel, it's a model of something. And all these models reduce the complexity of that which they deal with. So otherwise it's not a model. Then you can figure it out. So we have a very complex system. In order to understand it, we model it. If we model it with a model which contains all the complexity of the system, what's the problem? Now, it's just as difficult to understand the model as it was to understand the system. And you don't even know if this model is tracking the system, because you have to know all the complexity in order to see that. Is it still, you know, does it have the same inputs? And so there's a nice little engineering move I think one should make here. It is much better to use simple models that you understand and know when to stop using and when not to use, than try to build a complex model which you do not understand. So if this provisionality, this sort of modesty, doesn't mean you shouldn't model. That doesn't mean you should have a model that contains all the complexity. It means you should acknowledge the complexity and let that inform you in the way in which you deal with what you're dealing with. Whether you are you know, building a dam, or whether you want to describe quantum physics or whatever, biological systems, managerial systems, economic systems, the same, I suppose, the same kind of argument goes all the time. So that means that our models also should have this idea, this characteristic of provisionality, of revising them as in time, as conditions change, as the context changes, as our knowledge shifts. And it sounds straightforward, but we are not like that. We fall in love with our models. And then after a while, the world has to fit the model. Yeah, because this is really a very cute model, and I've spent 20 years developing it. So whether you're an engineer or a scientist or a politician, the same argument holds. So simply to say, I was wrong. This model is wrong. I must try something else. You don't hear that often, especially not from politicians. So I'm making life a little bit easier for you. It's going to be wrong anyway. We know that. So you can relax a little bit. And not cling to some kind of pride. This is no argument for laziness or sloppy work. You do it properly. But to say, I have to shift or change or adapt here, is a sign of maturity, not a sign of failure. Okay. So, we've said most of these things. So this idea of provisionality, I would say, involves a certain ethics. If we cannot model it perfectly, we make certain choices in terms of where the boundaries are, what we're going to involve, and what we're not going to involve. We don't have an algorithm for doing that. There's not a place where we can go and find the correct framework. Because then at that place, we would have had to have access to all the complexity. So there is always an element of choice when we model. And that choice involves values, and it involves something that cannot be reduced to calculation, which means that some sort of normative ethical component is part of the process of gaining knowledge in the first place. It is not as if we have knowledge and systems all rationally worked out, and then we have to apply it ethically. That too, but it's more radical. There is a certain sense in which the ethics becomes constitutive. It's part of how we get to know things in the first place. I am the kind of person that looks at the world in a certain way. And my science is not independent of that. It's part of it. And in this way, if we do this, I think it may also be an opportunity to incorporate more of our humanity into science. Also science into humanity, but to recognize that even as scientists, we are human, not just rational machines. And if we do that, then it may shift some of the aspects of science that's really problematic at the moment. If we look at the world and the state of the world, and I don't blame scientists for it, or not only scientists, but engineers, politicians, philosophers, all of them. If we recognize this human component in the way in which we construct knowledge, we may be a little bit more careful, so that we do not blame our models if things go wrong. All right. Now, that was a mouthful. I'm sure there are things you want to take up with me. And I am in no hurry, but I'm sure you want to continue drinking too, so. Yes, although I think this goes much further than Popper would, because this is philosophy of science stuff. You see, if Popper says something doesn't have meaning if it's not falsifiable, but it's false. Then once it's falsified, we can get rid of it. And in that sense, we have a convergent notion of truth. So eventually we will arrive at the truth. I'm not so sure that that's the case, on the one hand, because the system is dynamic. So I do not like the notion of truth, which Popper still has to hang on to. I like the notion of dynamic truth, truth with a small t, not with a big t. that are useful and where we can use the notion true quite easily, but not never as a way to fix the system. The other problem with Popper is the idea of falsifiability. To prove something wrong, what criteria do you use to prove something wrong? So the criteria for proving something wrong, according to Popper, they are objective. So I mean, he's just inverting a sort of an old kind of positivist reductionism. And if you look at scientific theories that changed the world, most of them were completely falsifiable at the moment they were presented. When Descartes presented his system, it was much worse than the Ptolemaic system. It should have been falsified. Yeah? But you should have... Now, see, I'm contradicting myself. What do you do? You hang on to your theory for a while. If I said we should not fall in love with our theories, it also doesn't mean you should discard them too quickly. There is a certain rhythm in it, sort of a pattern. So I've done some work on the idea of slowness. You should hang on to it for a while. You have to sort of cuddle it a little bit. But then at some stage, let's take a good look. but if you're too critical, you never get anything going. And if you're not critical enough, then you hang on to your to all your old bad dreams. So yes, there is something of the spirit of Popper in this idea, but in the detail there are also some differences. Well, somebody else has to answer that. I haven't done that stuff for 20 years. So. But yeah, sounds like it. Yeah. Iterative, provisional. Yeah. And if I know I didn't understand everything when I started, I will also be willing to shift and change and adapt as we go along. Yeah. So in a sense, I think, you know, this whole story is sort of a criticism against a certain style of thinking. It's not saying that nobody's got it right yet. I think many good scientists, even if they don't formulate it like this, know this. I remember the first time I stepped into an electronics lab after finishing my studies. The chief of the lab said, "Young man, electronics, you know the story, huh? Electronics is 10% calculation and 90% fiddling around." So they know that, you know, that you can't reduce it to some sort of pure form of knowledge that you must have in a pristine way and then apply it. It's messy. And I think it's this acknowledgement of messiness that engineers know in a certain extent, perhaps, I don't know, who shall we insult? Physicists? Whatever. So, but this idea that I have to do and look and do and look and do and sort of develop a solution, I think is not unnatural to engineers, except that sometimes you wish to have this, to compare yourself to this icon of science, of pure knowledge, and we are not secondary, you know, we are also scientists, and then you measure yourself against something that is not necessary to measure yourself against. If you look at the history of philosophy, I think you can trace this problematic back right to its roots. There's always been those who think in terms of essences, and those who think in terms of relationships and systems. And you get it right at the start. Plato was an idealist, and sort of things existed purely in some sort of abstract world. Whereas Aristotle said we live in the mess of this world and we get to know what we know through interaction and education. So right at the root of philosophy you have this. And you can trace this, you know, Kant was an abstract thinker, Hegel was a systems thinker. They all have their problems because Hegel in the end is also, in the end you get it right, like Popper. So you can trace this tradition. So I link philosophically with a number of with positions. Some of them are called postmodern. I don't like the word and I don't use it often, as opposed to analytical philosophy. So I say these positions are more sensitive to the complexity of the phenomena. I can provide reasons, but at the same time you can also give, because what I try to do in the way in which I unpack this is not to use any sort of mystical notions or, you know, or weirdness. Let's try to just do it fairly logically, and through the logical argument arrive at in this difficult place. In that sense, I think it is a way of giving substance to some forms of philosophy that people find a bit weird and way out. So I don't think it's not. On the one hand, it's not new at all. On the other hand, nothing is new. I'm employing a number of philosophical ideas that have been around for a while in a new configuration, so that some new understanding can emerge. You know, it's also, you know, when you ask, are you doing it? Yeah? Who is this you? It's a complex thing, this. Yeah? It's not me that is doing it. I'm part of a process in interaction with others that gathers ideas in a certain way that there is a new understanding emerging. And I think, well, at least people of my generation will recognize that there are different possibilities now than 20, 30 years ago, when science was still fairly rigid. So here, Nkosi, I think, is an example. Maybe they are not there yet, I don't know. But at least they're worried about something. If you think of the green movements, I know in the 70s, green politicians were terrorists, and they were bad, and now they are part of government. So there are shifts and changes, and I think it's a matter of deciding of what am I a part. Am I a part of those things that are of some kind of system that is concerned? That things, global warming, collapse of the economic system, these are issues that we should think about. Poverty, or are you one of those that says, look, man, got to work hard, earn a good salary, and drive a nice car? So I think you position yourself in all sorts of ways in what am I part of and what am I not part of, as opposed to some sort of crisp, clear thinking, this is what I am, this is what I'm doing. I think this is sort of an emergent thing. And this is the ethics again. We should be a little bit worried about what am I part of, whom am I relating with, who are my friends, what are the things that are important to me. We should reflect on them now and then. And maybe you can't change all of it like that, but you can sort of start shifting a little bit. And maybe the world will be a better place because of it. It depends what you mean with science. If you mean understanding, science as a collection of knowledge, as human beings understanding the world, I wouldn't call it subjectivity, but sort of an acknowledgement of human elements. I think that is important. I don't think human beings construct the world. You know, the world carries on in some way. So I'm not a constructivist. In the sense that my thinking about the world makes it what it is. Not in that sense, but in the sense that I'm sort of part of the process, and my understanding is not a simple mirror reflection, but it's an interpretation. I think that is becoming part of some sciences. The other part of the question, what is science? I think you can also ask what are the defining sciences at a certain moment in history. If you look at philosophy of science, you know, the examples they've used, Popper and Kuhn and Feyerabend, it's all examples from physics. Whereas in an age where we are acknowledging complexity, the examples are more and more from the biological sciences and the life sciences. According to some. So you have a difference between purely empirical sciences that are just collecting data, or theoreticians that are trying to understand it. So stamp collecting is not quite the right distinction to make. When I say biological science, I don't know what I mean stamp collecting. I'm asking about problems of life, origin of life, of evolution, of change, of how does, you know, how are we affecting the biosphere and those issues.
I've thrown away reductionism that just
well, if you say we talked about models, we have to reduce a little bit. So in a sense, the whole complexity position is an argument against reductionism. And then in the end, sort of half guiltily, we have to acknowledge that we still do it. But it's not the same, because we do it in a different way. You do it reluctantly, or you do it self-consciously. Yeah. And you do not claim an objective truth as a result of your reductions. You claim a sort of a necessary sort of move that you cannot avoid. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Well, even earlier, but yes. Well, I don't know. But we do model complex systems. We do predict the weather. And it's getting better. It's not good. It's not good, but it's better than it was 20 years ago. So, I mean, we do model. It's not that, but I don't know. I mean, I agree with you on one level, but on the other hand, I do not agree that we cannot model. In a certain sense, modeling is what we do all the time. Like, I'm sort of trying to model your question. You know, I'm trying to figure out. No, I'm not being facetious. You know, I'm trying to frame it and see what it means and where it fits in. You know, so if otherwise, I just say yes or no. You know, and then we don't get anywhere. So our engagement with the world is a sort of a modeling activity all the time. You see, the boundary is always related to the kind of question you're asking, or the strategy of the modeling. If I want to model you, you know, where do I draw the boundary? You know, at your skin? Well, that is maybe useful for some descriptions, but not, yeah, maybe some sort of physiological model of you, or so. But it's certainly not adequate for a psychological model of you. And even the physical one is problematic. Where does your brain end? At your skull? You've seen these sort of brain experiments where the split brain, where they cut the corpus callosum so it's two halves separate, so you can recognize something but you can't say the word. But if you just put the thing in the other hand, you can. So your hand becomes part of your brain. So under different contexts, the boundaries are different. So what you should do when you model or explain something is the conditions which enable that explanation should come with the model all the time. So you can be quite specific about something and model it quite precisely given the sort of, I don't know, physics would say initial conditions, but it's not like that. It's exactly the choices you've made in terms of how you frame the system. So it's not as if the frame is more or less here and it sort of can be a little bit like that. It can be quite radically different if you have a different strategy with your model. So this is part of the provisionality argument, that if when we claim something, it's always related to a certain strategy, which is also not crisp in any final way, so that we have to revise and change and adapt, but still say something quite precise. And sorry, I mean, I can talk about this for years. So the acknowledgement of complexity does not mean that you say something vague, sort of more or less. No, you say something crisp that can be understood, otherwise there's no point in saying it. But it's revisable. The fact that it's revisable doesn't mean that it's vague or relative. It just means you have something that's understandable that can be replaced with something that is understandable. For as long as there are snacks.
Lots of wine available. So thank you so much for coming tonight. I really enjoyed it. So thanks a lot.